Hello, UXers. I am so excited to share this conversation with Tara Codrington, who is a web project specialist at the Government of Alberta, and she's got a background in content strategy. So Tara and I met at the Design Content Conference in Vancouver in 2018 when we were both speakers there, and we just hung out for a very short time, and in that time of hanging out at the conference, I just really liked her. And I was just starting the podcast, so I immediately emailed her after the conference and was like, I want you to come on the podcast. And then we started trying to find a time. And then 2019 hit and life got crazy hard for Tara. And she's going to talk a little bit about that in the episode. But we finally aligned just recently to actually record this episode. And in those 2 years, I kind of like forgot why I liked Tara so much because it had been so long, and within 30 seconds of our conversation, I remembered exactly why I clicked with her. She's just so warm and quick to laugh and authentic and super freaking smart. So I just know you'll enjoy hearing about her journey and hearing her wisdom on how we can make content more inclusive. So, and I hope you enjoy this despite my bad audio. For some reason, my fancy microphone just didn't connect to Zoom. So, yeah, technology. Okay, but before we get into this episode, I want to let you know, or warn you rather, that there are only 4 spots left for cohort 3 of the OUX certification program. That's the object-oriented UX certification program. This is the 3rd cohort, and it's going to be awesome. So it starts on September 30th. It's a 10-week program. And I'm just going to read you 2 of the newest testimonials that I've received from cohort 2 participants. So Ali Agda, she's a product designer at Honeywell. She said, OUX is fundamental training for product designers architecting complex digital spaces suited to users' mental models. Divert those conference dollars wisely and choose to complete an OUX certification instead. And I guarantee you'll see an improvement in your design process. The versatility of the framework will give you better tools for stakeholder engagement and systematically designing more intuitive digital environments. All that, and you'll be learning from a very engaged community of experts. I know I've already received 10x what I paid for within a few weeks. I'm sure you'll find that to be the case as well. So thank you so much, Ali. Love that. And this is from Tristan Campbell. He's a freelance UX designer who has worked at H&R Block as a UX designer in the past, also Critical Mass for quite a while. And he's got a master's degree in library science and a master's degree in archival studies. So information architecture and organizing stuff is kind of his thing. And he says, OOUX and the Orca method are the best way to do information architecture that I have found. Full stop. Mic drop. So there you have it. If you're interested in wrangling complexity and a really practical way of how to do information architecture, how to take a bunch of research and a bunch of information and a bunch of data and organize it into something that design can hang on, you're going to really love this course. So check out all the details at rewiredux.com/services/certification. There's, of course, a link in the description, and I hope to see you. I hope to spend some time with you this fall. Okay, let's go talk to Tara.
What's up, UX designers? Welcome to the UX Hustle Podcast. This is a show about having fun designing intuitive and valuable experiences and crafting a fulfilling career within UX design. Now here's your host, Sophia Wojciechowski-Prater.
Tara, hello.
I'm here.
Hi, you're here. You're here. You're
Hello.
Here.
You would brighten that up a little bit. You can see I'm in my closet.
I'm in my closet too.
Because we're doing construction outside, and I was like, why would you do this today of all days?
Because you're recording a podcast. That's
why. Of course. So I was like, well, it fits. It's kind of cozy in here though, too. Like, I don't mind it so much. I'm like, oh, this is nice.
I know, actually. And all the clothes are great for sound insulation,
yes,
too. Right? So this is where I always record podcasts in the closet. So
That's why you sound so good all the time.
From one closet to another, from coast to coast. So can you believe it's been 2 years?
No, I mean, last year I feel like just wasn't even a, like, that was just like, I don't even like, it's like blocked out of my memory kind of thing because it was so intense. But 2 years. It's like when you had emailed me and you're like, oh, it's been a year. I was like, has it been? No, that can't be right. That can't be. What year is it? The worst year ever.
So do we, we don't want to talk about 2019?
And... Oh, 2019 was, it was just like, you know, it was mostly focused on just like my personal, like caregiving for my dad. And so that was just everything that I had sort of planned, like the first time we had met and I was like, okay, I'm going to start this project and I'm going to do this. And then it was like, everything was derailed and it was like, okay, well, this has to be like, family has to be my first priority and everything else we're just going to have to kind of put to the side. And now I'm getting back on it, like getting back on the track a little bit. And then of course there's COVID. So I'm just like, what? Come on. Like
2020 was supposed to be the year.
Yeah. I was like, so excited. All the plans, okay.
And all plans are just like, bye-bye.
Yeah, like, see ya. We're taking up. You're like, oh, okay. All right. I mean, I'm feeling it a little bit now. The momentum's a little bit picking up a little now that things not have settled in terms of COVID, but it's sort of like people are, it's not as like, you know, those first few weeks where everyone's like, what's happening? Are we going to work? Are we not going to work? Like, what are we doing? Is everything closed? Is it not closed? Can we travel? Can we not travel? What's, you know,
do I have to spend 45 minutes washing my groceries?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know, like watch this video on how to take your groceries from your, you know, outside to inside. You're like,
I don't wash my groceries anymore. I don't know if that's a bad thing, but
I don't do it either. I do wear a mask though. I do wear a mask.
I'm all about the masks. About the masks. I got my KN95 going on, but I'm not washing my groceries anymore and I'm not scared of my mail.
Yes. All right. Leave it at the end. I will come pick it up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's back up a little bit. Okay. So backing on up to you getting started in this industry. So right now you're a web project specialist with the government of Alberta. Mm-hmm. And can you talk, for those that don't know you, Tara, can you kind of like bring us up to speed? How did you get to where you are? And I know you have a history, you got a history in TV, also a little bit of customer service in there. So back on up and just give us a little bit of your origin story.
Okay. Oh, my origin story. I feel like a superhero.
You are a superhero.
So I graduated with a degree in English literature and I minored in publishing. And I thought I'm going to be a writer, maybe I'll work in publishing. I don't know. But the year that I graduated, there was a recession. And so there were no jobs. And right. And so I was like, okay. And everything sort of local where I was living in Vancouver at the time, things were shutting down and people were, you know, I'd apply for internships and they'd be like, well, good luck in this industry. It's dying. And you're like, oh, okay, well, this is great. Like, what am I going to do? I would either had to move east, which I wasn't really into at the time, or sort of work at a local paper or find something. And this is sort of, the internet is kind of like there, but it's not like it is now where it's like, oh, you can just go work for this, like, you know, digital company and be a writer there. None of that existed. And so I had gotten a job just copywriting and copy editing. And everybody who I worked with was so bitter and just so like, you're young, get out while you can. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was like, well, maybe this industry isn't where I really want to be because I don't really have that drive and that passion to just be like, it doesn't matter. I'm going to be scrappy and make my way out and I'll show you. Nor did I have any sort of foresight to say, I think this internet thing, I might want to try and start there. None of that. I didn't have any of that. And, you know, it's also about like, I got to pay the rent. So got to find a job. So I started volunteering. You know, great way to pay for jobs, volunteering. And I was working at a local cable company and they said, you know what, there's lots of jobs in this industry, it's really booming, you should go and study this. So I went and I studied broadcast television. So I have my diploma in broadcast television and that's where I got work like immediately. And I worked there in that industry for about 4 or 5 years or so, and got burnt out really quickly. It was really long hours all the time. It was kind of a really toxic environment. And then I kind of had to reassess, being like, is this really what I want to do? Can I endure this? And I'd kind of already sort of, I had friends who had stuck it through and were like writing for internet blogs and things like that. And I was like, oh, I wish I would have done that. And so they started giving me work, just like one-off kind of thing. Like, hey, I've got too much. Can you do this? And so I sort of did it on the side.
Like writing assignments?
Writing assignments, just on the side, and kind of learning a little bit like HTML, because I was like, well, maybe this will be a thing that I can do. And then I got to the end of my 20s, so I'm still working in television, doing sort of these things, and was like, I've never lived anywhere else. I'd like to live somewhere else. So I got my youth visa and I moved to Europe for a couple years. Couldn't get a job in TV, couldn't get a job writing, so I worked in customer service and I worked in a store. And that was really great. Oddly enough, that's sort of where sort of my UX kind of interest and training kind of started, is that I'd worked with different people who were like, I'm taking this, I'm studying this. And I was like, I kind of really enjoy that. So I took a course there. And I, within the job, I was like redesigning forms, being like, this form is very inefficient. Let's make it better. I was like, oh, I really enjoy this. Visa comes up. I've got to kind of decide where I want to go next. And I was like, well, I've got to go home because I still have a student loan at this point. And I didn't save any money while I was in Europe. So got back home. I had a friend say, you've been doing all this content work. You're good at it. I have an opportunity for you. You should apply for this job. So the job was communication coordinator, a catch-all phrase. It's a union sort of how they hire people. But the job would be writing for local government, writing website or writing web pages and working on the website for them. And I said, okay, well, it's a year contract. I'll go for it and see how I like it. And then I was there for 3 years. And the only reason that I left was for personal reasons, to come take care of my dad. But it was great. And it's really where I cut my teeth on learning about content strategy and UX and really getting into what the world of content is all about and how it can be made so much better.
So, yeah. So, and actually when you were, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you were in Europe, Germany, right? Is that right?
Yeah, I was in Germany and in the UK. Yeah.
And you were actually doing some teaching, right? Or helping people that are doing like some English as a second language teaching.
Yes.
So,
go ahead.
I was just, well, I'm trying, looking at the common thread, which, like, if you zoom out and you see this evolution, the common thread is language, right? Language, writing, editing. I mean, even the broadcast work, like the things that you were doing in the broadcast, was there writing involved with that as well?
There was a little bit. Like, I would write some voiceover stuff, and that's where I really learned about being concise and, you know, you can't use big words and really plain, a lot of plain language, to be honest, is what you're kind of, because it's like you've got 5 seconds to say this one thing to tell this whole story. So I did a little bit of that. And so I, yeah, now that you think of it, yeah, there is really that common thread, that it's always that language and interest in language. I would say that that's something that I've definitely always had, and has kind of led me to the things that I'm trying to work on now in terms of thinking about language, and not just plain language, but also thinking about the semantics of the language, and like, what words are we choosing to use to describe something, and how are we excluding things and people by choosing to use this word that, you know, well, everybody else says it. It's like, well, but we don't have to say that. And maybe just because everybody else uses that phrase doesn't mean that it's the right phrase.
Can you give an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of an example right now. I'm going to just start with my, I hate when I see click here, it's everywhere. And trying to get people to like change it. They're like, yeah, but I see it everywhere. It's everywhere. Like, I got it from the side, they say it, why can't I say it? And you're like, because it's not accessible and it doesn't mean anything. And right. it also kind of, you kind of assume that you're the person who's reading it's kind of dumb and doesn't know how to use the, you know, how they don't know how to use the internet, because they've clearly gotten to this page by clicking things or however they interact with it. And so all of a sudden you're like, now I'm unsure that they won't know what to do when they get to this hyperlink. So I must tell them to click here.
Yeah, it's a little patronizing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think, I mean, people obviously don't write it to be that way. And I don't even think that people interpret it that way. But that's definitely kind of how I see it, being like, you've unintentionally been patronizing. And we don't have to do that.
And so for the listeners out there, so Tara and I actually met. So we met in 2018. Like I said, it's been 2 years, crazy. At the Design Content Conference. And I was talking about object-oriented UX, of course, and you had a talk called Click It Real Good.
That's right.
Yeah. And then here's where we insert the salt and pepper clip.
That's right.
I'm not even going to try to sing it.
Okay, that's okay. How does it click start? It real good. Do, 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 do,
do, do, do, do, do, so we don't even need to do the clip because there you have it. Okay. So tell me so there's lots of problems with putting click here. Click here to do X, Y, Z. What makes that not accessible exactly?
Well, I mean, if we just think about, like, if someone's using a screen reader, this is the example that I use all the time. If someone's using a screen reader, they're going through it and it's reading everything and it'll get to that button and it'll say click here. That person doesn't know what that's going to lead to. Or even if you're not using a screen reader, even if it's just a assumed interaction, you're reading it, what's going to happen when I click there? Is something going to download? Am I going to leave the page? I don't know what's going to happen. And so, I mean, it's not a useful phrase for one. And I think there's also a little bit of ableism a little bit in assuming that whoever's interacting with your page is using a mouse. And it's, again, one of those things where I'm thinking about how we use language and how it unintentionally excludes people or people's experiences in how they interact with it or who they are. So by saying click here, you're like, oh, well, you obviously use a mouse to do this. So you obviously, you know, it assumes certain things that I don't think should be assumed, you know, and it doesn't have to be. Like, there's no reason that you have to say click here, you know, download, you know, our new brochure, read more about this law, for example, like, and those things are not something that assumes someone's ability.
And yeah, I totally get what you're saying. And also, it's when you say click here, you're assuming that the person has a whole lot of context around, like, what's going on around the page, right? Maybe exactly. A graphic or previous text. And what it's also, clicking here is a means to an end. So it's not the actual thing that is being done. What you're doing is you're downloading the brochure. So clicking is really just a mechanism. It's not the thing, like nobody's coming to this page to click. That's right, not what they're doing. That's not their goal. They're
just to click a bunch.
Let me go click around. Like, that's not, no user is ever coming to your page to click. Like, they're coming to do the actual thing. So we should describe that call to action by, like, what's actually getting done.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So you were talking about, like, other things, like going into, like, the things that you are working on today with semantics. Are these things that you're working on at your current job right now?
Not at my current job. My previous job, I was working on it. Okay. And I'm sort of trying to navigate sort of how I apply that to where I'm working now, and sort of, because it's a bit different in terms of the audience that we're working with. But before, like, we had a project that we had to rewrite a whole bunch of program descriptions for the recreation guide, for local recreation guide. And like on paper, it's just like an easy, you know, it was presented, here's a copywriting thing that needs to be done. And so I sat down with my coworker who she and I were both working on it. And we said, well, this is a really good opportunity for us to look at language and what that means to the people that it's serving. And because a lot of these descriptions are just written really quickly off the side of the desk by people, but we had this opportunity to really look at it and say, what are we saying about these programs and how can we make sure that the language is inclusive? And a couple of examples of that are Mother's and Father's Day events. So you'd have like a Mother's Day tea, and it was like, bring your mother to, you know, a garden tea. And that assumes a couple of things. It assumes that you have a mother, and it assumes that you have just one. Now, maybe you have two moms, or maybe you don't have a mother in your life, but you have a mother figure. How can we rewrite this a little bit more inclusive? So we came up with, I believe it was like, bring the mother in your life, or the mothers in your life. I think we had made it plural, bring the mothers in your life to a garden AT, or celebrate your mothers, you know, something like that. But making sure that when we were thinking about that language, that how can we make that more inclusive so it reaches really everybody. So it's not just that one person that has a mother in a sort of like nuclear family with a mother and a father, like, because family just looks so different. So we wanted to make sure that those instances, we were addressing that. And then the other one when it came to sports. And a lot of the program descriptions assumed that whoever was dropping in was able-bodied. And we're like, oh, this language is unintentionally ableist, because it just assumes that, you know, you don't need to adapt anything to play this sport. So we had talked to the program directors and sort of did a little bit of research to talk to people, like, what kind of things would you be looking for you to drop in if you had a disability of any kind? And it was like, well, we just want to know, like, what the skill level is, and is it accessible? Like, what sort of abilities do I need to have? So we started including open to all skills and abilities. And just by doing something like that, you're now opening it up to a broader range of people. So that's kind of the work that I was doing in my previous role in terms of looking at language and inclusivity.
And now, and I absolutely love that. I think that it's important to recognize for everybody listening that those small changes make such a big impact. I mean, just changing from singular to plural, you are including possibly a huge number of people. So it's not just like, oh, okay, we're including some people at the margins. Like that, you might have doubled your audience by making that distinction, the mother in your life, anybody that doesn't have a mother or has two mothers or has a mother figure. It's not just you could be reaching double the amount of people. And it's such a good example of how such a small change can make such a big impact. But the amount of thinking, like, can you talk about, before I move on to what you're currently doing right now, which I want to get into, like, what was the process of coming up with that language? Like, how did you work with your coworker? How did you brainstorm to come up with the mother in your life with that, or the mothers in your life? How did you get there?
Well, we started really just working individually, being like, okay, we know that we have to think about language, and let's just work on an individual basis at first and sort of go through it and flag anything that we notice. Because I think another important part of this story is that we were not decision makers at all in this. Like, I'm a mid-level employee. I recommend things, but I'm not in charge of changing things or being able to make those decisions. So we're like, okay, there's just two of us right now. So individually we can work, and then we're going to work together. And then we got together and we sort of looked at what we had, and we said, okay, there's just the two of us. How do we now go and talk to people to make sure that the language that we're using and the words that we're choosing are actually, you know, the good words to be using? So we don't have we didn't have like any sort of user research budget, or even mentioning user research. Sometimes I feel like in government it's like, oh no, you can't talk to people. You can't, we can't, the politics of talking to people is a little bit, ooh, it has to be like this big formal thing. And so we're like, how do we stealthily go and find and do some user research? And so we talked to the people that we knew in recreation centers, because at that point we had both worked there for a few years that we had built relationships up with different people in different departments. And we went to talk to them and kind of got them on the down low to be like, can you ask some people how, you know, what kind of language, or like, what do you, what's feedback that you get? And then we also scoured social media to see if there's any feedback that people were leaving to be like, I don't, this assumes that, you know, I can partake in this activity, but I can't because, or where people complained about having experiences of going to something and then they're like, oh, I didn't realize that it was only for people who have two legs. Like, I didn't realize that. And nowhere did it say. So we kind of started doing that kind of stealth research a little bit that wasn't going to raise flags as to like, you can't be talking to people. And then we just had a big brainstorming session. And then I would work on a set of descriptions. She would work on a set of descriptions, and then we would switch. And so we started sort of co-writing, which is something that we got from Sarah Richards' book, Content Design, where she talks about co-writing. And I was like, oh, we should do this all the time. So that kind of helped us to sort of break out of that bubble of just one person working on something. And then we got other people on our team to read it too, to be like, okay, we've done all this. Is there anything that you see that's not working, or something that you see that could be added to it? And we kind of did it that way. So it was a real kind of grassroots level kind of work that we did. Like, it wasn't anything that was mandated from a digital office that we could do. Like, so that's kind of how we figured that out.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love how you worked in research there. As guerrilla as it had to be. Did it kind of the work that you did there with that example and any other examples, did any kind of like style guide or principles or anything come out of that to sort of bubble it up to a higher level? So when other people were writing, they knew kind of, they basically didn't have to start from ground zero.
Yes. So we came up with a 2-pager of like, these are the terms that you should be using. This is what always has to be present if you're talking about this. And we documented it. And that is also a really good point. I can't believe I forgot to mention that because I love documentation so much. But document everything. We always documented everything that we did. Also so that when we leave, in which I did end up leaving, that whoever came next could see the work that we did and could see why we made those decisions, and then could use that for their own evolving of the style guide. Because that's the other thing too. It's like, it's not going to remain the same. There's things that we probably missed. There's going to be new programs that are added. So having that guide for people, or we're not even going to be the ones that are always writing it, because that is the thing that we were tasked with that at that one time, but we know that further down the line, it's going to be program directors that are writing it, or people who are just sort of admin assistants who are writing it. So they're able to look at that and be like, okay, well, now I can use this and make sure that it says that. And we provided the why we chose that language as well, because I think that's a really important part in doing any sort of content work with people who are still learning about content and what good content is providing the why you are doing this. Because just telling people use this word instead of that, don't say click here, but not telling them why, people are very resistant or like, yeah, but I can just do it, it's easier. You're like, mm-hmm. Oh, but once they learn why, you're like, oh, okay, slowly getting them on your side.
Yeah. And what did you call that document?
I think we might have just called it something really simple, like recreation description style guide.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
So you did use, so is there style guide, and then kind of like, is that different than a voice and tone guide, or do those kind of like overlap a little bit?
I would say it's a little different because the voice and tone for them were pretty consistent. Like it's, so the city itself had a voice and tone guide itself. And so we referred to that, mostly. So it was more of a, like a, like a how-to kind of, and these are the things that always have to be present. I will say, I don't think we were quite very good. We weren't that good with always like naming things the best. We're like, I just called it style guide. It's fine. People use it for that.
Well, our industry overall is not very good about naming things. So that's why I ask, because we all have different words for all our different artifacts. And that's one of my crusades, is to like, let's try to like get alignment on what we call all these different things. And
that is
especially
true.
Like in information architecture, especially content strategy, I'm not so sure about UX too. Gosh, we just use all, we're
we'll say that we
it.
Did try and at least be, we were trying to be consistent at least in how we named things, but it was like, you know, somebody writes something and they save it as something and it's, you know, file one version 8 and you're like, what does file one mean? I don't, you know, that's a whole file management's just like a whole other thing, because, and then, yeah. And then what we're calling things, style guides or voice and tone guides and all that's another.
Right. And actually my other question was on that. So going deeper into the details, like how did you house that document? Like where was it to make sure that people knew where to find it and people actually looked at it?
You know, I wish I had a really good answer for that and say, oh, we did this and it was really simple. And unfortunately, the file management was a whole, like I was fighting with that when I got in. I was like, what is this? And I tried to like be like, okay, we need to house these documents here and these documents here. So unfortunately, there was never really a consistent place. It's living with one person. I had asked her recently about it. It's living with sort of like one person. And she's like, I have it. It's emailed to people. I'm updating it, but I still don't know where it lives. And I'm like, okay, well, and that's sort of the frustrating thing I think about working in any organization, is that you can do the work where you are. And then when you leave, you're like, I hope you're still doing it.
Oh my gosh. I know. I've felt that way so many times. Like, meh, is it gonna continue? Or, you know, and sometimes I'll look at like what got launched 2 years after I left and be like, oh, I can see like a little thread of something that I worked on there. Completely watered down. That's definitely a common thing. So ideally, let me ask this. Have you seen this anywhere? Have you considered this, like having some of those style guides, writing tips, like we use this word and not this word, actually integrated into a CMS?
No, I think when I was leaving, they were changing CMSs, and that was something that was talked about. And so I am hoping that that's what they had. Like, there was a little bit of that in what we had, but mostly it was just a document that we would send people. And there was one person, and her job was she did all the training, and, you know, it went through one person. So at least there was one person monitoring it. It wasn't just everyone had publishing rights. At least there was that. But no, we don't. And in the current CMS that I'm working in, that wasn't even a thought. It doesn't exist at all. Mm-hmm. Which is a little bit of a pain point for me.
So you do think that would be a good idea, just to have more of that, more of those training wheels within the CMS?
I think if you're having multiple authors, then yes. I mean, you have to train people, and there should be, I think, maybe someone who is consistently looking through it to make sure. But the reality is often you're going to get different people in different departments uploading things. And, you know, how do we mitigate that until we can get to a point where we have a proper workflow? Is that I think having sort of those tool tips and sort of those reminders built within the CMS would be very helpful. It's not, I mean, it's kind of more of a Band-Aid solution, I think, but it's better than having nothing and then everything's wildly inconsistent.
Right. So the ideal solution is just really good training on the front end to make sure everybody's like writing and on the same sheet of music, so to speak.
Yeah. And that it's somebody's dedicated job, it's part of their job description that they're doing that. And they're not just sort of like randomly assigned this and like, or like, I have to figure out what, and are trying to like looking at different, I don't know how to write, I don't know. Because I feel that's been my experience anyway, is that I come in and that's kind of what's happened. It's not someone's job. It's not part of their job description. So they don't really know. But in, yeah, in my previous role, we were kind of starting that, and they were doing training for anybody who wanted to use a CMS. You had to go through training and you had to learn, this is what we do and this is why we're doing it. And I think it's just important anyway, because once you start planting the seeds, then it's, you start to see those consistencies when stuff comes through workflow.
Right. And I can see it being a really nice virtuous cycle too. Like the more consistency you have and people are reading other people's stuff that is also consistent, and then they're kind of like learning as they're seeing. Exactly. So speaking of job descriptions, can you talk to us a little bit about content strategy?
Okay. I was like, what my job title is currently. And I was like, oh, that means
there's nothing. That too. But like we have content strategy, which you've practiced content strategy. Can you like tell us how that fits in with UX and IA, and so UX information architecture, also like this UX writing thing that people are talking about now.
I know.
And then your current title is a web project specialist. Like, can you kind of like just piece all those puzzle pieces together for us?
Well, okay. Real easy question. Well, I'll start
give
off
me,
with a...
Give me your unified field theory.
title currently at my job is web project specialist, but I think that's going to change because again, that has to do with like union stuff and just like, well, we can't hire this type. We can hire someone who does this. And it's kind of, it's a catch-all title is what it is. It's in my previous position was communication coordinator, but I didn't really do any sort of traditional communications. I wasn't writing press releases, but you'd have somebody with the same title doing that job of writing press releases. So it's kind of just a catch-all title at the moment. And I'm always a little unsure and not really confident enough to be like, I'm a content strategist. So I kind of think of myself more as a content practitioner in that I learn best practices. I seek out content that I can make better. And, you know, and then thinking about just that sort of definition of content strategy about giving people sort of the information they need when they want it and how they want it and when they want it. Did I say when they want it? I was like,
where
they want it. That's it. I was like, where, who, what, why, where they want it, when they want it, and how they want it. And the how is also a very interesting thing that I'm interested in. And it kind of applies to some of the work that I'm doing before, because we assume that everybody's like, wants it digital. Let's make it digital. And you're like, oh no, but not everything needs to be digital. And maybe people don't want that information digitally. So that's sort of the next step of sort of what I'm looking at in what I'm working on and just talking to other people about sort of content strategy, sort of beyond the digital box, as it were. I forgot the rest of the question. Oh, right. How everything works with UX and IA and UX writing.
And you can just speak to it like within your experience or within your current job, like how you're working with UX designers, if there's even information architects present.
Well, this, my current job is just like a different, we're trying to figure stuff out is where it's kind of at. And just because of how things moved in the organization and like we lost developers and things like that. So that's a whole, it's all sort of come to like, so Tara, you've done some UX and IA work before. How about, you know, and you're like, okay. So kind of just taking that all on, which I think is very common for a lot of people in organizations where you kind of end up doing a little bit of all of it, or you end up doing all of it, and it's how you learn. But in my previous job, there was a UX team, and I was working with them with content because that was something that I noticed was kind of getting lost a little bit. It was a little bit separate, and I've kind of notice that too when I've taken any sort of UX workshops or things like that, is sometimes the content kind of gets lost a little bit and we start talking about interaction and we start talking about the actual physical sort of things. And I'm like, words are important and you should maybe I was trying to like, let's design with the words first and then we can add the things. And everything's important to do it all together. Like, I think that's the thing. There's not really anything that you can do one without the other. But often we're sort of taught this person is good at information architecture, so they do that by themselves. And this is UX, and you do this, and you do this. And at some point we come together further down the line. And then we always end up having to go steps back because, like, oh, we should have just been doing this together at the first place. Because now the IA person is called something different that the content person has called differently, and the UX person has designed something that's different that doesn't jive with those two things. So that's
you're hitting the nail on the head. I mean, this is such a common problem, and I mean, what I don't know, maybe you're being diplomatic, but do you really think everything should happen at once, or do you really think that the content should come?
It should probably come first. It should come first, but I mean, like, everyone should be in the room together, I feel.
Right, right.
I think that's what it is. It's like, okay, there is sort of like a way in which you do things and which things happen, but everybody should be talking about this at the same time. And maybe people lead different parts of the project, but everyone should be in the same room so everybody can put up their hand if they're like, I have a question about this, or have you thought about this, or what does that mean when you say this? Because going back to sort of how people call things, people call things differently all the time. And like, especially once you start throwing in acronyms, oh, forget it. It's like, I thought we were talking about subject matter expert. You have a different version of SME? What's that? You know, like.
Yes. And I think there's a really, I want to go back to that. I think there's a really good quote, and I want to say it's Sarah Edwards, but I don't remember. But basically, like, the same way that people aren't coming to the website to click, they're coming for the content, right? They're coming for the stuff, what I call the objects. And what we forget is I think the quote is something like, people aren't coming for the containers, they're coming for what is being contained. And what I always say is, like, nobody's coming to your website or your app for your calendar picker. You could build the best calendar picker. They're not coming. They don't care about your calendar picker. They care about the event. They're coming for the event, not the calendar picker. And I think with UX, we often get like so much involved with the interface and the screens and all the doing and all the interaction design that we forget, like, what are the things, what is the content that is being done to? What is the interaction that happens around that content? But we got to figure out the content first to be able to, like, really strategically figure out what interaction needs to happen around that content.
Yeah. And like, do they actually need like to go four steps in when you could probably just reduce that to one or two, because all they really want to know is what time the event starts.
Right. Like. Exactly. Exactly. Okay. We're on the same page about that. So what about you? Let's go back to UX writing.
Okay.
Do you know, like, can you shed any light on this? I am a little bit confused on the difference between content strategy. Well, actually, no, content strategy makes sense as something separate, but UX writing versus technical writing, I guess, is kind of where I get a little bit confused.
I do too, to be honest. Like, it's one of those things, because I kind of feel like UX writing should just be part of UX. I mean, like, if you're writing the buttons, and you're writing sort of like the micro copy, that should always be part of your UX process. So I guess maybe it's a way they separate it. I don't really know. Technical writing, I always think of more as, I think it's also because when I was first in university and I was like, I'm going to be a writer. I went to a technical writers meeting. And these were people who were writing manuals. And so in my head, for no matter, you could define it to me all the time, I will always associate technical writing with people writing manuals, which I guess in some ways is a very similar thing. You're writing about how to use a product, essentially. Right. But yeah, in terms of that, I kind of see UX writing as a very specialized thing that someone does if there's a UX team and a content team and everything. Like, you can afford to have somebody be a UX writer if you have all these things. But for the most part, I think if you're doing content writing, you're doing the UX writing. Like, it's, and if you're the UX person and you have to write some content, you're doing the writing. So I don't know if it's necessarily, like, I don't know. I feel like some people are going to have some words about this.
I was about to say, so if there's anybody out there that is a UX writer that can tell us what you do as a UX writer, please, you can tweet me at Sophia VUX, and I would love to hear that.
I think it's also like that whole thing with just like titles and like, you know, like we want to define ourselves or like, I do this thing, but really we're all sort of doing very similar work. Maybe we take on a more percentage of writing content versus UX, but it's all sort of there in the pie. Just like, yeah, I don't know.
It's all like a big messy Venn diagram. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing now at the Government of Alberta as a web project specialist. Like, what's kind of like a day in the life? What does that look like from your home office?
Oh boy. So I was originally brought on to do the content strategy for one of the microsites. And it was a microsite that they had managed to sort of, that this department managed to get. And, but then like the whole, this, I like, this is where it just comes, like the work itself is a lot of just prepping because there's a lot of politics happening behind the scenes of who owns this and what can be said on it. So it's not even, I'd love to say that I was like, well, I'm working on this project where I can do this thing and I'm doing this work and I've done all this, you know, it's at this point, it's a lot of behind the scenes work doing like, okay, so if we get to have this website, this is what the content strategy could be, but we don't know if we're going to have it. I don't, you know, so it's a little, yeah, I don't want to get myself in trouble by like saying too much about the politics of it.
Right.
Well,
how about, so you've mentioned some challenges with working in government, and I've had some government clients as well. So I understand a lot of those challenges. So, but there is something really cool about working in government because there is this feeling that you can make some really big, interesting change. So for those out there that are like, I would love to be applying my skills, my UX skills, my content strategy skills, my information architecture skills, I want to get into that. I want to start innovating within government and helping the digital systems because, I mean, personally, I think this is just, there is so much work to be done within mm-hmm. government and we're just so behind. And it's a kind of a tragedy how I think globally, I know in the US, sounds like Canada, you're probably dealing with some of the same things, but we're just really behind the curve. And there's so much we could do to be serving citizens better, right? So for those that are excited and like the idea of working in government, like, what would you say to them? Like, what would you tell them to watch out for? How would you encourage them? What would you say to those people?
I'd actually, now that you're talking, I was like, oh, there are some things that I was like, oh, wait, Tara, you got focused so much on the things that you can't do. What about the things that you are doing? And one of them is, we're two co-founders, and then I've sort of the Government Alberta's digital community of practice, and that's Jessica McQueen and Sophia Hussein, and they co-founded this community of practice, and they brought me on board because when I saw what they were doing, I was like, I need to be a part of this, to sort of bring people together within government who are doing content work, digital work, who aren't part of sort of like the bigger content sort of Alberta.ca team, because there's that big team up there, but there's a lot of us still out there kind of doing some work or haven't necessarily been hired for that, but find themselves doing that. So that's one of the things that I am doing for my job is connecting with different practitioners across the government and trying to come up with events and things like that where we can learn together. But to answer specifically more your question, for people who are interested in coming into government or who are consultants who are working in government, I think beware sounds so scary, but maybe be mindful.
Prepared.
Prepared, perhaps is a better word. Yes, prepared that what you're proposing isn't going to necessarily have the budget that you want or the resources that you have. So it's, I think the one thing that I'd really love to see people or consultants come in is to really think of, imagine these people don't have anything and there's only one person. How can you give them the tools to help them start this thing, this bigger strategy that you're suggesting, because I've, my experience has been like, we get people to come in and they're like, you don't have any governance and you don't have any, you need like a digital team and you need all these sort of things. And you're like, yes, we know, but we still need to do this work. So how can you help us do this work even though we don't have that? Because it's a long, it's, you're playing the long game in government, I think, because everything is a little bit slower. And so that would be probably, yeah, my number one thing is like, be aware that you're just playing the long game. And even when you start out and you're like, I'm excited, I have all these ideas, you got to be prepared to plant a little seed and to tend to it for a while before it grows. No one is just giving you sort of carte blanche on this garden that you can just sort of rearrange and like make perfect. It really is just starting slow and starting small. But the great thing about working in government is that when you get those successes, they're so rewarding because you know that they're helping somebody directly. And because it's like a public sector job and the work that you're doing, it's not trying to get your company more money. You're actually like, you can like change people's lives. Like that sounds so like grand and dramatic, but it's like, if you rework the content and now somebody knows how to apply for a grant much easier, and it was, you know, you've made the, you know, there's less barriers for them to get through because you've sort of worked through that content and you've worked with people to be like, oh, this is how they can do this. Oh, they don't have to go to step 1 through 30. It really can just be reduced to these kind of things. I don't know. I kind of went rambled on there, but.
No, I think that that's really interesting because what I'm hearing is one, patience. You have to be a patient person. Yes. So those that are not patient people, myself included, probably it's not the best route to go into. But that also there's something really beautiful about the fact that even though you might have to be more scrappy and resourceful because budgets and timelines are all kind of, you often don't get all the space that you need. The space that you do have, it is 100% about the user, because there's no, like, there's the business entity isn't there being like, oh, well, we have all these business priorities. So now we need to compromise what the user wants with what the business wants. So you could have a really big budget, but the work that you are doing within that budget, if you're in like a startup or something like that, is like oftentimes to please stakeholders, shareholders, pleasing the business. But it does sound like in the space that you do get to play with, which might feel like a small space, it is all like you're trying to help the end user, and you do get to kind of focus on that. So that's
yeah, that is true. And that is a really big part of it, is that it is kind of nice. Like you do get to like throw that around a lot to be like, well, about the user, like what about the citizen? What about, you know, and it's really hard for anybody to be like, oh, well, you know, to talk, you know, to say anything against that. They're like, oh yeah, okay. Especially if like you can prove that that's what they're saying. Oh, well, then you're set. Like you really get to advocate for the user in a really rewarding way.
Because that's citizens. And that's what the government is for, is 100% to serve citizens. Yeah. Ideally, that's what it should be for.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully that's what the government's there for. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about complexity. So you are all about making the complex simple. Mm-hmm. And this is something that is very near and dear to my heart. I often say that like object-oriented UX is a complexity wrangler. Like it helps you like sort of break down complexity. So I am a complexity simplicity geek as well. What is your process like, or what do you look for? What are some key things that that are part of what you do to help reduce complexity, to untangle complexity, and to find simplicity?
I talk to people would probably be, and it sounds so simple and obvious, but I think sometimes you get handed a project and someone's like, make this better. And it can be so tempting to sort of dive in and do sort of like try and start making spreadsheets and doing this and doing that. It's like, but you've got to go back to the beginning and be like, okay, what is this? What's the history of this and why does it exist? And you need to talk to people to find out, yeah, the history of what it is. Why does it exist? What is it that you want? Like, I always try and go to the business unit and be like, so who is this for? Like, what do you, like, define that audience? Because again, seems like a really simple thing, but a lot of people will, especially in government, they'll be like, it's everyone. Yeah. Like, well, everyone's like, I get that we're like for the citizen, but like, at what point in their life are you, is this information for them? At what are they doing? Like that. So those are things where you can narrow down your everyone to something a little bit more specific. So I try and talk to people about that, finding the history of it. And then I ask them, usually, describe this to me like I know nothing. Because they've written something down that they want you to do, and or that they want you to edit, or they want you to change, or that they're like, I want to build this thing. And you're like, well, explain it to me now without paper, without words, just like, or just with words, sorry, not without words, without paper. Just explain it to me like I'm 5 years old and you're trying to explain to me. And usually that's when I feel like you kind of start to see people be like, oh, well, maybe it doesn't need to do that. Maybe we don't need that. Maybe that is a little bit too complicated. And that's where I kind of really start to sort of do the work to try to pick apart sort of what it is that they want to do. Why is it that they want to do it? And also sort of what is the, I was talking before about like how people want the content. Is this a product that we actually need to build? Or is this something that can just be a one pager of information? Or is this something that really just has to be for your audience is just a pamphlet? And not making it as complicated as we need to build this interactive, questionnaire so that people can know whether or not they have COVID, for example, you know, it's like, just give, it just has to be on a sheet of paper, the information. But, you know, cause people also just don't have time sometimes. Anyway, that's my mm-hmm. whole thing with this. I was just about to go on a rant with the, like, you know, the COVID. I don't know if you've seen these where it's just like, do you have COVID? And then they ask you questions and it's a questionnaire and you go from one page to another. And I'm like, this is so inefficient. Yeah. I don't, yeah, sorry. That was my little, but an example of like how you make something that should be really simple, way too complex.
And what do you think, like, it's such a human tendency, like there's also a good quote on this, we just kind of like tend to make things more complex than what they need to be. Like, why do you think we do that? Why do people create things that are more complex or kind of add extraneous pieces to stuff?
Yeah, I think for some of the things that I've seen or why people want to build certain products is this is not answering sort of the human question of mm-hmm. like the really like, why is it that we need to make things complex? But in terms of sort of websites or technology, it's people will go, I saw this thing once that I really liked. We should build that for us. And you're like, but do you need to? Do we need that? Maybe that was great for their audience. Is that for us? But I get that all the time where people will send me like a link to something and be like, we need this. And you're like, okay.
It's jealousy. It's comparison and jealousy.
And it's wanting to be like, look how cutting, especially in government, they're like, look how cutting edge we are. And you're also, but sometimes I'm also like, we don't have the budget to build something that looks like that. So whatever we have is going to be mediocre and it's going to be terrible for the user.
Oh my gosh, you're so right. And it's like the joke that we all always make about the company that has a website and they're like, we need an app. And you're like, what is your app going to do? Mm-hmm. I don't know, but we need an app. We need an app in the app store. And it's this like, keeping up with the Joneses kind of this, like, I need to keep up with the Joneses and I'm looking over the fence, the grass is greener over there, and not asking why, like not really, like really looking into it, asking why. And if we don't do that, then we just like, we it's the same thing as like kind of materialism, how we end up with so much stuff because we're like, we don't ask why we're buying something. We don't ask why we're bringing something into our home. And then we end up with this like really complicated set of crap. I'm about to be packing and moving. So that's kind of what's on my head is like, why do I have all this stuff?
I want it. You're like, yeah. I know. I definitely need this like hydroponics thing too, because I just want to grow some parsley. And you're like,
okay. Instead of like putting it in a pot.
Or even asking like, Have you grown something before? Will you be interested in growing things long term? Are you growing through winter? Like, why do you need this specific thing? It's a very like, yeah, like, why do you need this? Is this going to be a long term app that people are using? Or are you just building it for like 4 months worth of, you know, something?
I think it's so funny. Like, I mean, entire organizations get spun up because why isn't asked enough? Like, why isn't asked five times? Okay. So I have just a few more little questions for you. So one question that I want, that I'm super excited to ask you is about how, I don't know, I have a feeling there's something here, maybe not, but like, how do you apply content strategy and keeping things simple to your own life? Like, does it manifest in any way? Like, and we're getting, this kind of is a nice segue to like stuff in organization, but like, I'm thinking like your Google Drive folder or like your email, like, do you, in general, are you kind of an organized person with all your content? And do you have any tips for us?
So my natural state is chaos. I definitely just like everything everywhere. And I think maybe that's also why I'm drawn to content strategy a little bit. And all this is because I also yearn to sort of contain that chaos and to be more productive. Because if I don't write lists and I don't organize my emails, like I have like everything in my email is like, I have everything by year. At the end of the year, I go and I like categorize everything. And then within my inbox, everything is also sort of like these newsletters for this and this, like,
I knew it.
Like everything is categorized and I automate everything. And, but it's really just because otherwise it's just way too much information. And so I do find that, and I'm the person too, that comes into like a new job and I'm like, what is this file structure? We need to fix this. This is horrible. Who named these files? Like, what is this? You know, not even like really what they hired me for, but I was like, let's make this a little bit better also on the back end so that our front end can be better. So yeah, I would say like it's, I don't know if it creeps in, but it's all sort of encompassing just the organization of things to make it easier and to like, to give people and myself just more time, you know, because no one wants to spend a whole bunch of time on a website trying to figure out how to renew their driver's license. You're like, just give, if you, we organize the information nicely, there it is, then it's really easy. And then you save people time and you've saved yourself time because no one's going to be calling you.
Right. So it's so funny you say your natural state is chaos because I'm the same way. And people would like look at my stuff and they would be like, no way, you're a super organized person. And I'm like, no, I create systems because I have to create systems. Otherwise, I can't get anything done. And I was 100%. Talking to my husband about this just last night about how, like, if you want to do complicated things, like if you want to do bigger, complicated things, you have to create kind of more systems. Like systems are sort of like what make you superhuman. And if you don't have all those systems, especially if your natural state is chaos, it's going to be really hard to get stuff done. So I have to like, it's basically like, not crutches, but I have to like overcompensate for the chaos by like creating, making things really, really organized. I do need to work on my file names though. My file names, like I do not have good file naming structure. I just throw everything in folders. So before I let you go, one little last question for you. Where do you see content strategy, the work that you're doing, like where do you see this going in the next 5 years, like for you personally or for the industry, like thinking future long term? You said you were playing the long game within government. What does that look like in like 5 years, even 10 years?
I think what I would like to focus on and what I would like to see more is accessibility in everything that we're designing. It's still an afterthought in so many things. I think government's getting a lot better at it than sort of more private industry, but accessibility for one, and getting people to think about that from the get-go, not as an afterthought, not just thinking about accessibility in terms of color contrast, because that's the one that I always get. Well, the color contrast is good. We've met our accessibility needs. And you're like, no, that's not, no. And seeing people testing their content and testing their websites and testing their products with a different range of people and for yeah, for especially for people who have disabilities, because we all are going to experience some sort of disability in our life, whether it be permanent or temporary, or we're going to know people. And I think I would love to see, I mean, that's more sort of like what I would love to see, is more focus on accessibility and representation in what's being created and what's being put out there. And that's something that I particularly want to focus my career on. Because I do believe it's so important, because we shouldn't leave people behind just because it's easier to do so, you know? So where do I see it actually going? I have no idea. I am a horrible sort of future, like, as like, I have no idea. I'm like, I sort of think I'm trying to manifest the future that I want to see within the industry. And then hopefully by talking about it, other people are like, ah, yes, I never thought about that. I'm interested in that too. And so that's kind of, I think for me, what I personally am going to try and create those waves rather than try and think about what could be, because I'm just horrible at predicting anything.
And I should rephrase the question. It's more like, what do you want to see? What do you want to see?
That's what front of mind.
Yes, I'm right there with you. And we could probably go down quite the rabbit hole on manifestation and putting things out there into the universe, but we're gonna put this out there into the universe. Hopefully more people will hear it and they will get inspired. I know that they will. So Tara, thank you so much for joining me here. It was an awesome conversation. I learned a lot. And I don't wanna keep you too long, so we're wrapping it up.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I hope that, like, you know, people listening, especially if there anyone's like junior or mid-level, especially, can get some sort of like ideas on how they can do the work, even if they're not decision makers. And for anybody who is not thinking about accessibility, to really start thinking about that from the very beginning and all throughout the process. And it should just be part of the toolkit. So that's my hope of what I have babbled on about.
And I agree 100%. And I feel like we have a follow-up episode to talk about structured content a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because I know that OUX is good for accessibility. Mm-hmm. I know, but I don't know enough about, I'm not an accessibility expert. I should be, but I'm not. And I would love to like hear more about how like the work that I am doing. And even how to like tweak it, even like, I mean, like even when I'm going through and I'm saying like, okay, here's all the attributes for a certain object. And like, we're saying like, okay, we got a title, we got a description, we got a picture. Okay. We need alt text for that picture. Like just simple things like that. Like thinking about, okay, do we need extra fields for accessibility? Do we need extra attributes for accessibility? And then like certain fields, are there accessibility ramifications for certain fields? Like if I have date and time, like, okay, what do I need to think about around date and time from an accessibility standpoint? Is there like a formatting that's best? I mean, like these are things that I don't know.
Yeah, no, and same here. Like those are the things that I'm interested in learning about, because I think I really want to become, I want to be an advocate for people who don't always have the ability to advocate for themselves, you know? So that's, I can't answer those questions right now because I don't know, but I'm learning and I'm really interested in learning. And I mean, I think that's kind of one of the most fun things about this industry is that because everything's changing, we're always learning and hopefully for the better. But that's what I really love about it. It's just like, oh, okay, we've did this, we created this. You know what? We've realized we've made mistakes. We can do that. I mean, unintentional mistake. I don't know. That's a whole other, I feel like, discussion about sort of thinking about mistakes and like what we're doing unintentionally.
Yeah.
But I think we're on the same page and sort of thinking of just like, how can we really make sure that what we are doing and creating is for the greater good?
Exactly. Exactly. It was so great catching up with you.
Too. All right. Thanks so much. It was nice to see you again.
It was nice to see you too. Bye, Tara.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for hanging out with the UX Hustle. For show notes and more episodes, go to uxhustle.org/podcast. And remember, don't wait for inspiration to act. Act to get inspired.